Hey, Idaho Matters podcast listeners. It's Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. Idaho is back in national headlines after the Utah women's basketball team experienced a racial harassment incident in Coeur d'Alene while participating in the NCAA tournament. This isn't the first time Idaho has made national news for racist incidents. And some are now asking, how did we get here? When did Idaho's racism begin? And how has the area nations in North Idaho been allowed to grow? Today in the podcast feed, we're bringing you a conversation we had with Dr. Jill Gill, a Boise State history professor back in the summer of 2020, when our country was grappling with racial injustice and questions about white supremacy. Now, almost 4 years later, we think it's still important to examine our roots so we can better understand how we got here today and what steps we can take to be a more inclusive and equitable place for everyone.
Dr. Gill, first, can you tell us quickly about your research on racism here in Idaho? How long have you been doing this work? And really, what drew you to it?
I started the research in about 2012, and I'm from Seattle, Washington. I'm a native of the Pacific Northwest. There was not much taught about race when I was coming up through school, and then I went back to Philadelphia in the 1980s and 1990s, and Philadelphia was in a kind of a racial crisis that was, you know, paralleling what was happening in Los Angeles and other types of places. And I really wanted to learn more about race to understand the world outside my front door. And the Pacific Northwest had been ignored. You know, anything that I studied on race in school tended to focus on the South. And then as attention moved to race in the North, it was always these big cities that were had big interracial populations. Those are easy to study. And the civil rights movement was easy to look at there because you had these clashes. And places like Idaho were treated like a flyover state. And I even heard from Idahoans who said, oh yeah, we didn't have any racial issues here. We didn't have any racial discrimination because there were too few Black people to even be racist against. So of course it didn't exist. And I wanted to look into that because I knew even just from the Black History Museum that that wasn't
right.
True. And also the fact that we have a kind of an innocence narrative here that plays off of the Aryan Nations, right, being up there. Mm-hmm. But I wanted a bigger story than that. You know, we seem to focus on the Aryan Nations, that that's somehow the beginning of where Idaho began to have racial issues or was getting slandered. And so I wanted to see if I could unpack that. And there's quite a story there. So I'm researching for a book called, I think, Idaho in Black and White. It's going to go from the 1870s up to the present. And it looks at the racial dynamic between Black and white mm-hmm. Idahoans and lays it against the national backdrop. What can we learn about the larger national story from Idaho? And how does Idaho play into that national story? What's similar to the national story and what's different? And also what Idaho can tell us about, you know, its connection to how race played out in the North.
Right.
With respect to systemic racism. Yeah.
I think that's so interesting. So I grew up in Chehalis, which is about an hour south of Seattle. And, you know, this is, there's something about the Pacific Northwest where you don't see, or at least when we were growing up, not a lot of diversity, right? And I have this memory of meeting one of my dear friends who had moved to the area. He was from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, African-American. And I remember I was about 19 years old and I said, well, I said something about, well, there's not racism here. And he was like, trust me, it's here. You just can't see it. And at least in the South, it's in our face and we see it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
And there,
right.
And so what I'm curious about is Idaho, because I think the same could be said for Idaho. And you call yourself an activist historian. So before we get into the history and all the way back to Civil War, talk to me about what you mean by that.
Oh, thank you for that, because history gets used for a lot of different things. It gets used for commemoration and genealogy and sometimes just for hobby curiosity. An activist historian believes that history is essential to confronting and solving problems effectively today. You cannot address a problem unless you know the roots of the problem and the patterns by which a perennial problem perpetuates itself. So history is used diagnostically. It takes its seat at the table with other problem solvers. It's a social science as well as a humanity. And so you have to dissect the country or Idaho's history, kind of like you cut into a frog and see actually what's happening there and what perpetuates things. It's a data driven, kind of a cold hard look at why things are happening, how they perpetuated, what are the incentives, the whys, the hows, the so whats, and the reveals whats in history. It's the same thing you would do if you're trying to solve a personal perennial problem, and you might go to a counselor who takes you back into your own past, right? You can't solve a personal problem today that's perennial unless you understand, where it popped up
where
in your childhood.
Where it comes from, yeah.
Right, right. And sometimes exactly. You need an outsider to help you do that. So historians just do that on a societal level. And I do think it's essential. If you don't know the roots of a thing and those patterns, you might misdiagnose and produce a solution that doesn't solve.
So with that being said, take us back to the Civil War era and the white flight that really was happening from the South. So, I mean, who was coming to Idaho at that time, but also why were they coming?
Yeah. So back at the time of the Civil War, and this is actually a Pacific Northwest thing. It was a Pacific Northwest regional thing. And then Idaho is the state in the Pacific Northwest that most perpetuates this now. And I'm actually borrowing from a scholar here named John Dipple. He talked about this flood of what he called plain folk Southerners who were leaving the South in the 1860s and 1870s as the Civil War dislocated the world in which they live. And enslaved peoples were freeing themselves amidst the Civil War, right? And you have battles coming down and so on. And so you have this flood of Southerners, as well as, there's also some we might call Copperhead Northern Democrats that are moving into the Pacific Northwest because they see it as a free labor zone, which was coded as white. They wanted to go to an area of the country that was white and where they could perpetuate a kind of, for lack of a better word, the kind of white monopoly that they were used to. Right, because their world is getting more multicultural. The monopoly in the South is breaking down. And let's remember too that after the Civil War, the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th Amendment frees the slaves in 65. The 14th Amendment gives African Americans citizenship and civil rights in 1868. And then the 15th Amendment gave African American men the right to vote in 1870. That is also disrupting a kind of a white monopoly in the North. The North didn't have slavery, but it had a Jim Crow system. So there was many places in the North that didn't allow Black people to vote. And they were treated as a caste, sort of a caste group with different laws and segregated. And so these laws are changing white people's lives, North and South. And so you're getting a flood of people that are coming into the Pacific Northwest. And Oregon in the 1850s had already passed things called lash laws, which were designed to literally lash Black people in the public square if they didn't leave Oregon. And so the Pacific Northwest was this area where they wanted free white labor to be able to operate without a multicultural environment. And, people like the Aryan Nations and so on tried to perpetuate that same kind of vision of the Pacific Northwest. And so here's the interesting thing with Idaho. Up until from the 1870s to about 1920, the state that gave us the most in-migration was Missouri, which was a slave state. Missouri and Utah were the places we were getting most of our in-migration. And we had very strong Confederate strongholds throughout the Pacific Northwest, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, that were strong Confederates. Idaho City is a great example. The mining and timber areas in Idaho were predominantly Confederates. So Idaho City's newspaper, the Idaho World, was owned and run by Confederates. You've got place names like Dixie and Atlanta. Stanley was named after a Confederate captain.
Really?
Right back, Gold, all these names are place names that were people that supported the Confederacy and what it stood for. Now, there were also Republicans here. The owner of the Idaho Statesman ended up being a radical Republican, and the Idaho World, but Idaho City and the Statesman were kind of in a smack talk, you know, dynamic through the Civil War. But this is, you can also find this in Washington State and Oregon. So this was a really, very much a regional thing at this time. Like I said, Idaho just ends up carrying forward these patterns a little bit longer than these other states. But they were very much looking for, like I said, a white place to live where a white person can work and operate without having to deal with competition, if you will.
So a very homogenous yes. existence. Right.
Absolutely. And white flight, that's what white flight is about. It's really about trying to get to a place where you can preserve a white monopoly.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Boise State History Professor Jill Gill. We're looking at Idaho's racist history dating back to the Civil War era. So let's talk about the fact that when people were coming to the Pacific Northwest, to Idaho, white people were coming here for that homogenous existence, but also looking, you know, for land, right? To have a home, to homestead, all of that. We need to recognize the fact that they were taking that land from indigenous people. I mean...
Correct.
Right. And then there were the Chinese immigrants who also came to Idaho because they were mining, they were building our railroads. How did racism, white racism, play out with other minority groups besides just Black individuals? Because we have quite the history here in the Pacific Northwest when it comes to internment camps.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So let me bounce back. You're getting onto a lot of really important things there. And this kind of actually harkens back to one of your previous shows where you asked a really great question. What's the root of racism? And your guest talked about race as being rooted in an idea. From a historian's perspective, that idea emerges in the context of colonization, where you've got, and this is happening between about 1600 and 1800, where you've got white Europeans who are coming into the Americas for land and then the resources that can be produced from that land that give them power, right? And that they can fight wars, you know, like the Spanish are coming over for gold, and the French are coming for fur, and the British are coming over for tobacco land and later cotton land. But that means taking land away from native peoples, and then you have to find labor that you can exploit. So they tried doing that with indigenous populations, later moved briefly to indentured servants. That wasn't practical, then moved to slavery. So you're building white liberty, which is rooted in land and the resources you can get from that land, off of stealing land and labor from other peoples. And so what we create in this country is what some people call a Herrenvolk democracy, which is a democracy that puts white people as equals under the law. So they're the ones that can have access to the American dream, can have access to citizenship, can have access to the vote, homesteading, and all those types of things. But it's always, there's this caste system that's underneath that's exploitive, that's connected to other peoples of color, whether it's the labor of Chinese who weren't allowed to naturalize. They couldn't become citizens. Same thing with Japanese until after World War II. Asian immigrants were not allowed to naturalize, which meant they couldn't vote and they couldn't have power in the society. They also couldn't often buy land. You're taking land away from native peoples during the late 19th century, the period we're talking about, and putting them under reservations. And between the 1890s and 1920, the population, native peoples, are being so repressed that more are dying than being born for a while. You've got African Americans, right, that are being Jim Crowed during that period of time. And the Chinese are getting, even though they built the railroads and brought all their skills with gardening and laundry, there's the Chinese Exclusion Act that happens during this, after the Civil War. And that was being pushed by a lot of white labor unions that didn't want the competition. You know, and that's what we see in the Pacific Northwest. We want this to be a white working man's area. And so the Chinese, who made up about 28% of Idaho's population in 1870. By the time you get to 1920, it's down to 0.5% because they're being driven out. And Idaho is getting whiter. So in 1870, if you look at that first census, Idaho was 71% white. By the time you get to 1920, it is nearly 99% white.
Wow.
Driving out the Chinese, putting native peoples onto reservations, and then, like I said, they're being put in a fighting for their survival Even the African American population dropped a little bit during that period of time, from 0.4 to 0.2%. So Mexican immigration at that time was still fairly small. And so, yes, this is Idaho whitens during that period of time, and it is connected to the resources that can be got from colonization and control of labor, mm-hmm. and then control of the political power that comes from that. That's actually what John Lewis was fighting against, right?
Right.
It's not just
right.
an idea. It's the fact that white people are getting something out of this that they don't want to give up. Monopolies are a restraint on competition. And when you're trying to create a democracy, as John Lewis was, you have to make that good trouble to try to push people from the opportunities they get in a monopoly to truly wanting equal, fair competition.
Well, it truly has to be equal and fair. I mean, that is
exactly.
what a democracy is supposed to be. And it hasn't
right.
been, right? I mean, that's just pure fact. So Dr. Gill, is it fair to say too, that it wasn't just Southerners though, who really brought
yes.
racist and anti-Black
yes.
sentiment, anti-Chinese sentiment to Idaho in the post-Civil War era? Because we
correct.
Have a whole issue with mines in North Idaho, correct? And that played into it?
Absolutely. No, that's such a critical point that we need to remember this. The whole battle with respect to racism in America is a national issue. It's been a perennial fight. Gemma, if the South was only 11 states, okay, and after the mm-hmm. Civil War, their economy was only, they only had about 24-25% of the wealth of the country. So the North had a lot of power. And so did the West together. And if they wanted to create that, second reboot after the Civil War and have a true democracy, it could have. It's the fact that the North gave up. The North really didn't want it. The South lost the Civil War. The North puts in these, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, and then it goes back on it. The North made a choice. So the North has to own that. You're absolutely right. A lot of Northerners did not want to give up the white monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the North invented Jim Crow. They didn't have slavery up there after, it was phased out of the American Revolution, but it had segregation, it had housing discrimination, it had segregation of schools, it had job discrimination. So Northerners that are moving into the Pacific Northwest are bringing that with them as well. And in many respects, the Republican and Democratic parties, white Northerners and white Southerners, the Supreme Court, Congress, and the presidency from the 1870s into the period of John Lewis, kind of all were in cahoots to keep a white monopoly going. So yes, that is all part of Idaho. It is a national issue.
Mm-hmm. We need to take a quick break. We're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Gill regarding racism in Idaho with a look at the early 20th century. Stick around. You're listening to Idaho Matters. This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and we are continuing our dive into Idaho's history of racism with Boise State History Professor Jill Gill. Now, before the break, we were talking about how Idaho was already establishing itself as a white state where racism was tolerated, the years with before statehood and as we became a state. But Dr. Gill, I want to ask you something before we kind of head into the early 20th century. You mentioned, after the Civil War, we know the South lost the Civil War. You had the North right. and you had the West, and they really could have come together to truly make a true democracy. What I think is interesting, having grown up in the West, is there is an idea, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we were never a part of the Civil War, right? Our hands are clean. This, we came out here to the Oregon Trail, and it was pioneers and we established the land. And there is a sense of not wanting to take any responsibility. Would you agree with that? And if so, that has to play into where we are now.
Yeah. I think it does feed into what the West might consider its innocence narrative, that this mm-hmm. was a place where democracy could play out. And indeed, there were a lot of African-Americans, too, that came into the West with that kind of hope. But people brought the structures that they had from back East with them. They just wanted the liberty more for themselves. But there were clear and intentional things that happened out in the West to, you know, to Mexican Americans and to Chinese, to put particular kind of taxes on them out here that would penalize their race if they were trying to mine or things of that nature, or to buy land. And so that's all part of the Civil War. I mean, it's all part of whether you're exploiting a particular kind of labor or not. Mm-hmm. And that people did bring their sentiments, you know, they brought their sentiments with them. I mean, the Idaho State Journal in the 1950s, I was looking into the articles, and they would talk about how people in Pocatello would cheer for Ole Miss when the football games were going on, that people would put Confederate flags outside of their houses in places like Pocatello and so on. That's an identification, you know, with right. the broader country, even as we also try to separate ourselves from it. Idaho was a territory created as a territory during the time of the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln created it because he saw so many Confederate people moving up here into the mining districts that he wanted to make sure that the mineral wealth out of Idaho could come into the Union. So he created Idaho as a territory to ensure that the Union had access to that mineral well. So we were always tied, even if we don't want to admit it.
Right, right. So one of the most visible, but frankly, most violent racist groups that had a stronghold in Idaho in the earliest 20th century was the KKK. Can you tell us about how this group actually gained traction in our state, but also how they operated?
Yes. So the Ku Klux Klan would kind of reboot itself. They called themselves the Ghosts of the Confederate Dead after 1866. They were sort of squished during the Reconstruction period, but they rebooted themselves as a membership organization in 1915, stimulated sort of by the movie, D.W. Griffith's movie, Birth of a Nation, which heroized mm-hmm. the Ku Klux Klan as being the savior to restore civilization and order to the South. It made it a hero. So, that went national in the 1920s. It controlled states like Indiana's politics. It had a huge presence in the politics of Oregon. And it was very Protestant, 100% American, anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Black. What we can tell is that, from my research, I've found probably 12 to 13 chapters of the Ku Klux Klan in Idaho so far that popped up in the 1920s, and at least three women of the Ku Klux Klan chapters. From what I can tell, the recruiters came down from Washington and Oregon. They would organize on the down low until they had a substantial membership role and money. And then they would pop out in a big way. In September of 1923, the Ku Klux Klan chapter of Boise popped out. They put an ad in the Idaho Statesman to advertise this big parade they were going to have and this initiation ceremony. And then they had it. And they had a parade with floats and fireworks, which were expensive back then. They had the money for pyrotechnics. It was so big, it created traffic jams downtown because they marched from downtown to the old fairgrounds. And then they lit crosses. And they had a Ku Klux Klan initiation ceremony. Our archive here also has pictures of marches in 1924 in Napa, in Payette. Pocatello had a very virulent Ku Klux Klan and a women's of the Ku Klux Klan group. And they specifically, even if there were a small population of African Americans, because African Americans had the smallest population of peoples of color in Idaho, the Klan would still target them. had a little Ku Klux Klan chapter in Shoshone. And I think there was one Black man who lived there. And the Klan beat him up and shot his dog. The Klan would march around the Black neighborhood in Pocatello, which was, between Pocatello Avenue, Center Street, and 1st and 3rd Street. They'd march around that singing racist songs. And the racist songs from the Klan are in our archive. Their little song sheet is there. There are interviews in our archives of African Americans who grew up in Pocatello who remember being held by the hair by white Klan members and when they were kids, and white kids would punch them in the face. There was a rumor that the Klan in Pocatello was going to burn down Bethel Baptist Church, which is a Black church there, and the Black men got together to try to defend it. We had a lot of, there was a Klan group that attacked a Black woman in her home up in Lewiston And she was so frightened when she saw him, she ran out the back door. We have the charter of the women of the Ku Klux Klan. They were feminist racists, Gemma.
Feminist
they
racists?
They have a belief. Feminist racists. They believed in women's right to vote. They wanted women to be able to do all the things that men did, including burn crosses. You know, I mean, so their charter from October 1925 is in our archive. Their belief statement is there. And one of their robes, one of the women's robes from Payette, is in our state museum. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't have to believe me. We've got pictures.
There's proof.
You know, we've got newspaper articles. And it was pervasive. I'm not done looking, but I've already found 12 to 13 of these chapters.
So
and
here's what
the
I'm
picture in the Idaho Statesman has these people, you know, they're smiling. They're actually posing for the Statesman. And one guy brought his kid in a little Ku Klux Klan outfit. So they're proud. That tells you something, that the norm, mm-hmm. And these are people of status in society, that the norm accepted them, that they'd be proud to have their pictures and their faces shown in the paper.
Well, and that's the thing. So one of those pictures we are going to post on our website for listeners, if you do want to see it, the one in particular about where they were unmasked, as you mentioned. With that being said, and how prevalent it was, I mean, a parade with fireworks, right?
Yes.
How did the politics support this? I mean, of course, I mean, I'm assuming, I mean, you know, white leaders, but what was the reaction to this?
I've looked a lot at the Idaho Statesman. The Idaho Statesman, which was owned by, you know, a Lincoln supporter, a radical Republican back in the day, they were clearly torn about this. And there were clearly some people in Idaho that didn't like everything about the Klan. But the fact that you've got people of prominence that are proud to show their faces means that they're not fearing a political backlash or an economic backlash to their well-being. That tells you something. That they're willing to be out there in public. And the pictures, too, show huge crowds. The picture of the march in Napa and Payette, there are people lining up on the street in their Sunday best clothes with flags. So, and it's a big crowd, like you would come out for a 4th of July parade. So that tells you something. Now, the politics of the time are interesting. We're looking here at the 1920s. William Borah was our, the Lion of Idaho was our senator at the time. And he was sadly doing everything he could as a moderate Republican. There was a series of you and I as Westerners, the Western branch of the Republican Party tended to get in league with the Deep South in a states' rights alliance against civil rights legislation. So during this time in the 1920s and the 1930s, William Borah and his colleagues in California, Western Republicans, lined up with the South in a states' rights alliance to block anti-lynching legislation every time it came up. And
That
was really well known. Block it. In fact, William Borah, he was considered the second most powerful man in Washington, D.C. He was considered the Congress's constitution expert, and he operated almost like the South's defense attorney against anti-lynching legislation. And he put it in a states' rights context, and he talked about how the South was given kind of a raw deal with Reconstruction, that the 15th Amendment should have never been passed, that gave black men the right to vote, and that, lynching is bad, but the South sometimes needs to use extra legal measures to deal with something that was put on them that shouldn't have been put on them. Let me tell you a quick little antidote, because women are fighting for the right to vote at this point, right? And
right.
Borah was in favor of women's suffrage, and Idaho had given women the right to vote in 1896. But Borah was the only senator from a suffrage state that was not in favor of a national amendment for women's suffrage. And he said, that's because I don't want to give black women who are not prepared for the right to vote, access to the vote. Repeal the 15th Amendment first, then I'll support a national amendment. So otherwise, women had to do it state by state. And those women actually that talked to him and were lobbying him figured out that he was trying to position himself for a run for the presidency, which he did in 1936. He wanted Southern votes, and the Dixiecrats loved him. The South loved William Borah. He supported putting a Robert E. Lee statue in Statuary Hall in the Capitol when the South wanted to do that. I mean, they loved William Borah. And so he actually helped worked against his party. In 1920, the Republican Party had promised to pass anti-lynching legislation. And it was the Western Republicans, particularly Borah, and the Dixiecrats that killed it. And the Senate had never passed it.
So how did
so that... that's the politics that are going on.
Yeah. And yeah. So then how did that play out then? How was that received by voters in Idaho with this, when he opposed anti-lynching legislation and doing what he did?
Let me qualify and say that Borah was not in favor of lynching. There's actually a story from 1903 when he was a lawyer where he actually helped get a black man who was being pursued by a lynch mob. He got into a fight after a baseball game in Napa. And as a lawyer, Borah helped get this guy on a train to get him out of Napa so that he wouldn't get strung up. At the same time, he admitted also that if white women were being, quote, endangered by black men, that maybe in that instance, lynching is okay. Okay.
Okay.
But he veiled it in states' rights, and he knew what was happening. I mean, the anti-lynching movement in America was huge. Ida B. Wells and the NAACP. The people are getting slaughtered, killed. There's horrible hate crimes happening down there, and he was putting that as second fiddle to his states' rights trope. So, so there was some division in Idaho, but hey, he was Idaho's most powerful person in Washington, D.C. I don't get a whole lot of white people that were up in arms about his position killing it. And in fact, the folks in California, they were against anti-lynching legislation with Borah because they didn't want to see it as a slippery slope to have to allow the Japanese into the schools in California or to allow the Japanese or Chinese to get land. If one civil rights legislation goes through at the federal level, it can go through for other groups. And Borah ended up saying to the California folks, yeah, we don't want that to happen, so we're going to stop that. So I think, a lot of white Idahoans kind of went along with it. I will tell you that black Idahoans, at this time in the 1920s and 30s, the clubs, the churches, and particularly the clubs, were bringing up the issue of anti-lynching over and over again. They were having programs and debates and talks and stuff to try to shine a light on the fact that anti-lynching legislation needed to be passed. And one more thing. When Borah ran for president in 1936, the nation knew, black people particularly knew, that he was a key person stopping anti-lynching legislation. There's a picture from Getty Images from 1936, New York City, the headquarters of the NAACP, they were carrying signs that said, "If you endorse lynching, endorse Borah." That was in 1936 when he was running for president.
Wow.
If you endorse lynching, endorse Borah. That's in New York being held by leaders of the NAACP. So that's the reputation he had.
Yeah. I want to thank
you so much.
Didn't
hurt him here, though.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Right. I want to thank you so much for coming in today and talking about this. You've gotten us up to the 1920s and 30s. So I want to flash forward to the end of World War II and the time when Black GIs were returning to the United States, because that was a completely different experience for Black GIs. And what in particular do we know about these GIs who were coming back to Idaho?
Well, the World War II brought a lot of airmen, particularly to Idaho. We didn't get the wartime industries that the states to the west of us got, which really brought the Great Migration and sometimes doubled African-American populations. Mm. But Boise and Pocatello got folks that went to Mountain Home, Gowan Field, and the air base out of Pocatello. And many of them stayed in those places and worked, and they were part of segregated units. And they met people here, and they engaged in the Black churches here and the other civic organizations. They sometimes got married here and stayed. So the environment they found here, and in places like Pocatello, these airmen alone coming in doubled the Black population of Pocatello. So that was pretty dramatic. And they came back to an Idaho that really mimicked the kind of Jim Crow, it's sometimes called James Crow, that was popular in the North. So we didn't have school segregation here because there weren't enough African Americans for that to be practical. But there were public accommodations segregation that was pretty widespread in restaurants, hotels. Playground equipment in Pocatello was pretty much off limits to Black kids. The YMCA was off limits there. Many theaters either kept Black people out or they had to sit in a special section. This is all in Idaho, Boise, and Pocatello. Black people were not allowed to try on clothes or return clothing from department stores. There was job discrimination, housing segregation, which was rampant. So it was. This is very typical with respect to, you know, the northern discrimination that these guys came back to. Yes.
And as we know, I mean, Idaho was, as you mentioned, very white. It still remains a majority of a white state. So how many people did these discriminatory policies affect? Because was it only focused on Black people, or was this, did we see this in just people of color overall? And if you could include a couple of specific examples, maybe from different parts of the state and what people had to deal with. I mean, you mentioned, you know, like in the Pocatello with the playgrounds.
Right. So in northern Idaho, I know that the unions, which were fairly radical in supporting, you know, the white working man, were very anti-Black. Senator Mary Lou Reed, longtime Coeur d'Alene resident and representative, talked about the fact that the unions kept Black people out. So as of 1970, there were only 9 Black people, I think, that lived in Coeur d'Alene, simply because wow. they kept folks out. I know in across southern Idaho, both African Americans, Latinos, and indigenous populations ran into signs that said, you know, essentially no people of color allowed, and they would use fairless notations of that. I actually saw a picture of a sign that said, "We solicit white trade only." That's a direct quote that was on a brand new bar called the Cowboy Bar that opened in October of 1954, just a few months after wow. the Brown decision. And it was in the Pocatello newspaper. And the newspaper interviewed the owners that opened this bar. And they said, yeah, we wanted to advertise that we're a clean, safe, respectable establishment. So saying we only allow white people in was a way to code for that. Oh. Most often there weren't signs, but I do know that people saw signs around. You just learn, you know, where you could go and where you couldn't go. It was pretty clear. And you would get, you know, retributions if you crossed a particular line.
Can you talk about redlining? This is a word that's come up recently as Americans really grapple once again with systemic racism, because it is still here. Can you define it? And then share an example from Idaho during this mid-century time.
Sure. So redlining was actually part of federal housing policy. And it worked in conjunction with local segregation policies to basically box African Americans out of the housing market when, you know, housing was kind of the number one ways to build retirement, to build a nest egg, to pass on your kids, and to rise up, if you will, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. So redlining was a policy that basically said, if the federal government is going to back bank loans for housing, you know, that really cool 30-year mortgage, you know, low interest, no money down kind of thing, it had to be in a neighborhood that was, quote, green-lined. And they used colors to codify whether they considered a neighborhood a good investment. Okay, so if the federal government's going to back that bank loan, that is seen as a good investment, you know, where the housing value is going to go up, good schools, yada, yada. Well, they used race to determine that. So a green area was a white area, just assuming that a white area is going to have all those qualities. If there was a certain percentage of people of color, the colors would go from, you know, yellow, orange, and red would be predominantly a Black neighborhood. And if a place was redlined, it would not qualify for that federal security for bank loans. And therefore, banks would not give African Americans those good loan rates. They would use gouging rates. They'd, you know, give them 15-20%. And, you know, had to get more money down, and they would do things like contract buying, which pretty much prevented most African Americans from being able to safely and securely buy a home. And again, this is, you know, this period of time after World War II, between 1840s and the end of the 60s, was what we call the golden era of the American economy. There was no better time in America for people to be able to to, in some sense, you know, achieve an American dream. We've kind of lost that since the 1980s to that extent. And African-Americans were boxed out in one of those really critical ways. Jobs, schooling, mm-hmm. too, was all part of that. So it was really insidious. And not only did the federal government have those policies, but then you had realtor steering, which local realtors did. You had housing covenants. And these are examples I can give you from Boise and Pocatello, where, you know, the housing covenants, I have copies that I can show people from Morris Hill, from off of State Street, that pretty much said, and it was standard language that you would also find in California, that nobody other than a white person can live in this home or buy this home unless it is a domestic servant domiciled with the family that's a person of color, like a maid or a gardener or a nanny. So realtors combined with banks, combined with housing covenants, combined with these federal policies, were all collaborating.
And we should note, I mean, in Boise, I mean, there was a Red Line River District, and that is, and that's River Street today.
Yes. I mean, yes, and the, yes, that's right. And the, you know, there's a map, there's this cool map in the archive in the YWCA papers that anybody can get to from the 1960s. And it shows how effective it was because for every, there's these little black dots that are in the River Street neighborhood, and you can see all the black families that were clustered there. There's a few random little black dots, black families that lived off of Harrison Boulevard, up in the foothills and off of Warm Springs, but those were workers who served wealthy white families. Hmm. So that shows the effectiveness of this. And the other thing, housing segregation across the North was the key way for James Crow to operate mm-hmm. on all kinds of different fronts. If you can segregate housing, Gemma, then you can do job discrimination because you have to put an right. address on your job application so people can suss out your race without even asking by your address. Mm-hmm. You can gerrymander school districts. You can gerrymander tax districts, voting districts. You can, you know, the zoning in the River Street neighborhood was zoned for noise and warehouse and industrial, whereas white neighborhoods were zoned to protect them more. And then you can do gouging, which is crazy. They could control the supply and demand. If there's only a small area where black people can live, and they did this in Pocatello in really vicious ways, you can create an overcrowded situation in the black community, because they won't let black people live outside of that. Then you can gouge them on rents and purchases, even mm-hmm. though they're often getting a substandard place compared to what white people can get. Mm-hmm. It was exploitive.
And then this goes into that whole idea of generational wealth. And you mentioned this in the beginning of this conversation, that it's this idea of you buy a house, you build equity, you know, you can retire, you can then, you know, pass that house along to your children. So then there is that generational wealth. Your child, you know, gets a house from you. You have something to leave them with redlining. African Americans, black people, did not have that opportunity. And I think it's critically important that people understand that, I mean, this was created to make sure that black people could not build generational wealth, could not make their situations better.
Correct. Absolutely. It's critical. And that particular time period, like I said, was a really vicious time to do it because this is when housing values really shot up. It was a booming time economically. And it was a time that a lot of white Americans moved from the poor or working class into the middle class and then got to secure their places there and you know, upgrade and, like, again, pass on that wealth. And it goes along with the job discrimination and, the discrimination with respect to schooling and stuff too, that are mm-hmm. all part of, you know, improving your prospects in life. So you bet, you can put a dollar sign on all of this. And it was done through a series of local, state, and federal policy.
Let's move into the 1960s when the civil rights movement was happening. And there was a resistance to it in Idaho, correct?
Yes, there sure was.
can you talk a little bit about what we were seeing? And part of it was the people that were, frankly, starting to visit the area, in particular, you know, Aryan Nation founder Richard Butler.
Yeah, he was one of our, he was probably our most infamous white flighter, right? So he and his wife, mm-hmm. Betty, were flying up here. They had a private plane. He was a millionaire by his mid-50s from Lockheed. And they were coming up vacationing, from what I can tell, in Idaho in the late 60s. They eventually bought land in 1974. But yeah, he's up, you know, hunting and fishing and talking to people in the Albertsons and the Stinker Station. You know, I mean, they knew Idaho pretty well before they bought land up here. And yeah, I think one of the reasons that he bought land up here in 1974 and built his compound and started the Aryan Nations by the late 70s is he gambled on the fact that in addition to, you know, having liberal gun laws and cheap land and a kind of a live and let live atmosphere, which he wanted, and it was sort of isolated, he also gambled that Idahoans were on his side of middle. They weren't as extreme as him. But, you know, when he's talking to people casually, he's picking up on race was his number one subject. He was already a white supremacist. He belonged to the Church of Jesus Christ Christian when he was down in Southern California. So he's ensuring, you know, he's putting his toe in the water. And what he was hearing gave him a sense that this would be a place that would at least, like I said, be on his side of middle. And he'd have if not a hands-off atmosphere, there would be some people that might be open to his message. And I think, you know, I have seen in the letters that came from all across Idaho, massive numbers of letters that your listeners can look at that were mailed to Frank Church. All his constituent mail is in the special collections at Boise State University. Or if you're up in Northern Idaho, you can look at Compton White's mail up at the University of Idaho. I looked at every single piece of the mail they got on the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, which was designed to end segregation in public accommodations and job discrimination. And Frank Church, who was a co-sponsor of it, didn't think that Idahoans would get whipped up about it because there were so few African Americans and so on. It's not going to impact the state greatly, but they did get whipped up. And he said his mail was running 10-1 against the bill at one point. And there's just, wow, you know, huge boxes of this stuff. I did my own poll and I got about over 70%, between 70 and 73% against. And it was pretty strong. So I figure, you know, when Richard Butler's up here flying around and talking to people casually, he's going to hear those private sentiments, because mail that goes to a politician, they didn't know that, you know, that Boise State is going to save that stuff.
Right.
They thought they were giving a private audience, being able to give their 2 cents to their elected officials. So it was not friendly. And there were actually huge organizations in Boise that came out against the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. The Idaho Farm Bureau ran a letter writing campaign against it. So they used the Idaho Farm Bureau affiliates to campaign and lobby against the bill. The Haley, Kimberly, and Sandpoint Chambers of Commerce were against it. The Gooding JCs, the Canyon County Republican Booster Club, the Sun Valley Women and Professional Women's Club was against it. The Women's Christian Temperance Union was officially against it.
Wow.
And I could go on. So, and it also cuts across class, workers, doctors and lawyers against it all around the state.
So then we get to what, at least in the last maybe 30, 40 years, that Idaho has become infamous for, and that was the Aryan Nations. And, you know, this idea that Idaho was, if you're a white supremacist, come to Idaho. And how does that play into the bigger story of racism in Idaho? Because growing up in Washington State, I mean, you know, all I ever heard about was white supremacists and the Aryan Nations. And that was my idea of Idaho.
Yeah, that's right. And in some sense, that's where we think the story begins and ends with racism,
right,
in Idaho. We treat it like, and then we treat, you know, the bad image that Idaho did get nationally because of the Aryan Nations. They got a lot of press back in the East Coast newspapers. We treat it as a PR problem. But when you look at it historically and you stand back, there are waves of white flight that come into Idaho, and they preceded, and they've also come after the Aryan Nations. And so we talked about the Confederates that were fleeing, looking at the Pacific Northwest, you know, last time we were together, that was a fairly white place for, quote, free labor, which was coded as white. those waves continue. And as time moves forward, eventually, you know, it was always Washington, Oregon, and Idaho that were sort of seen that way, Montana as well. But as the I-5 corridor diversifies, and that starts with World War II, with all, you know, these wartime industries that are shipbuilding and airplane building and so on, a lot of African-Americans move into Seattle and Portland, San Francisco and LA. And eventually those population bases become more democratic and they become extremely diverse. Well, the whiter regions of those states that are somewhat more conservative started to feel like the political base of those states are pulling in a different direction. But Idaho is still one of the most rural states in America, and it's one of the most conservative. So if you are somebody who lives in Southern California, like Richard Butler, and you see the Brown decision and the, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Fair Housing Act of 68, starting to allow African-Americans and other peoples of color to move into jobs, schools, and neighborhoods that they hadn't been in before. And if you're discomforted by that and you're hearkening for a past of Leave It to Beaver, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Idaho is going to start to look very attractive to you. So we saw waves of white flight after the in the late 1960s and early 70s, Richard Butler was part of that, running away from that diversification. We saw further waves of it in the 1990s after the Rodney King riots in the South. There's one historian that called the highway from Southern California to Idaho the White Flight Highway. There's a writer who wrote a book called Watopia that talks about that, the number of U-Hauls that were coming one direction. And then now,
It's still happening today.
Oh, absolutely. Richard Butler's been dead since 2004. He's buried up there in Coeur d'Alene. And the Aryan Nations are gone. They were bankrupted by the Kootenai County Task Force on Human Relations and the Southern Poverty Law Centers for $6.3 million in 2000-2001. But yes, there's new groups up there. There's the Readout Movement. There's the Northwest Front that actually talks about the Butler Plan, which is about, you know, reconstituting Butler's old idea that the Pacific Northwest would be a white supremacist or white separatist area with Idaho as the headquarters of it. They actually call it the Butler Plan. And then there's another group called Road to Power that are up there in Northern Idaho. And they're calling to white people who live in the West, right? Eastern Washington, Eastern Oregon, Eastern California, outside of LA. You know, if you feel like you're being inundated by peoples of color, you don't like the cultural changes, they can use the same coded language for white as that, you know, that owner of the cowboy bar did. Come on up to Idaho where you can help us hold turf and you can have political power and an environment, cultural environment that is more like what you are missing. And that
I need to cut you off.
Work.
Yeah. And it continues to work today. Yeah.
It is working. The great number crunchers at the School of Public Service at Boise State University, they do great demographic studies and political science studies. And they have looked at the incoming migration from Southern California. You know, are we replicating ourselves? Or, you know, what is it? What does it make it? Because you got all these economic refugees, right? Sell an expensive house, buy a cheap house.
And Jill, I have got to cut you off. We're running out of time. I would love to have you back on and continue this conversation. We've been talking with Boise State University history professor, Dr. Jill Gill, about the history of racism in Idaho. More Idaho Matters coming up tomorrow. Hope to see you then.
Again, that was an interview we originally aired in the summer of 2020 in the shadow of George Floyd's murder as we look to unpack Idaho's complicated racist history.